Welcome to this special edition of the IRIS podcast, taken from the 2010 IRIS Forum. This edition features a talk by social entrepreneur Andy Gibson.
Hello, I'm Andy. I'm from the internet. I live primarily on Twitter and sometimes in London, and it's a joy to be up in Edinburgh. Thank you very much for inviting me, where you have amazing things like hills and trees, and it's incredibly, the colours are so much clearer than they are on the screen of my laptop. It's wonderful. But I'm actually by profession, I guess I'm you can tell perhaps from the wild look in my eye and my unkempt appearance, I'm a social entrepreneur. I spend my time trying to create businesses which don't just make money, they also make the world better, as if building a business that made money wasn't hard enough. And so I do various things all in the space of social media, social web for good. So I create businesses that, like schooloveverything.com, which is a platform where anybody can post up what they could teach and offer that as a service to the people around them. Like Mind Apples, where we're asking what's the five a day for your mind. And I also write and talk about things like this, you know, and generally it's all about kind of web for good. It's like this, there's this thing called the internet, and apparently it can be used for good stuff as well as, you know, being rude to your mates and buying shoes, which is kind of what we've used it for so far. But I'm a historian by background. I drifted. I'm not really a technologist. I don't really care about technology. For me, the journey and all this stuff started from being a student of the history of the Renaissance and the Reformation, and it goes back to 1517, you know, which is the time when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses onto the door of, I think it was All Saints Church in Wittenberg, and perpetuated a sequence of events which 4 years later led to him being excommunicated. Then you get a ripple effect through Europe. You get Jean Calvin, you get Zwingli, who go on to influence the Kirk up in Scotland. You get Melanchthon, who influences the Elizabethan settlement and the Church of England. A few years later on, you've got suddenly the Dutch have rebelled against the Spanish crown, and actually France has disappeared into civil war, and they're tying people to trees and burning them, and it's all a little bit complicated. And then 1618, you've got kind of everybody in Europe suddenly fighting, and Sweden invades Germany, and it's where did Sweden come from? We didn't even know they were there. It's really confusing. And the ripple effect of this actually is far beyond anything that Martin Luther could ever have envisaged, and actually he died knowing that all of the things that he'd been trying to do to reform his church had failed, because he had scattered the churches, and it was a disaster for him. But the reason that I'm bringing it up is because the thing that made Martin Luther's thesis travel was obviously the printing press. And the printing press created mass communications. It created the mass production of content in a form that was distributed through the communities, and it turned what for Luther was an academic debate within the church into a mass phenomenon that builds a middle class of educated people reading the Bible in their own languages. Then, you know, fast forward 100 years, you've got people critiquing the monarchy, and suddenly you get the English Civil War, and actually that was the social change of that technology of the printing press was far beyond anything that anybody could have imagined. And I believe that the work that I do now, I do because I think that the internet represents just as fundamental, if not a more fundamental, revolution in our society. More fundamental, potentially, even than the Industrial Revolution, although it's perhaps not necessarily going to be felt in the same way. And I think the Industrial Revolution is the other thing to bring into this, that for a couple of hundred years, we've been taught that efficiency means centralization and mass production. And that's actually come from the time of the printing press as well. The efficient way to put knowledge out suddenly stops being to have a church and lots of priests and you tell them what to say and they all say it, and starts being actually we print something and we give it to everybody. And you fast forward again and you get the radio, you get TV, you get all of these broadcast media which are all going out into society and telling everybody the centralized message. And similarly, if you wanted to make, say, a badge-making company, so you want to produce badges, then you build a factory which makes badges, and you design things, and then you mass-produce them, and then you sell them to everybody. The internet is different. Does anybody, just by show of hands, know what Web 2 means? Few people, yeah, Web 2.0. Basically, they made the internet, did pretty well, made quite a lot of money, and so they thought, let's make a sequel. I mean, you know, there's why not, you know? But they didn't really have much of an extra plot. They just kind of basically ran out the thing again, you know, same as with many sequels. Web 2 is actually very similar to Web 1, but it's what the internet is turning into. And if you want an easy way to remember it, the way I think of it is Web 1 is using the internet to connect people to information, and Web 2 is connecting people to other people. And the internet it started as an information medium, and what it's become is a social medium. And when people talk about social media, they don't mean because it's used for socializing. They mean because it's a society. It's actually how we communicate with each other in work, play, every area of our lives is being mapped and amplified by these tools. So who's on Twitter, by show of hands? Obviously, you're still twitting, so you can't show me. But yeah, okay. So quite a lot of you still. And on Facebook, everybody's on Facebook. Most people on Facebook. No, some people aren't. Good. Okay. Excellent. Less money for Facebook. Well done. The main thing to realise is that the platforms don't really matter. The platforms are changing all the time. The way to think of it is that what we are seeing being built is a new infrastructure for our society, and it is just as fundamental and transformative as the railroads were in terms of communications and our capacity to act. And if you think of it in those terms, it becomes easier to understand why, firstly, the government shouldn't build its own railroads just for itself. It should probably use the ones that everybody else uses, because that would be more efficient. And secondly, that it becomes about actually all of us being part of a social change which is nothing to do with us, and we have to respond. So we don't have an option. What happens is people say, can you come up for a meeting? And you go, oh, no, I don't use the trains. You go, but why? They're great. Come on. Come up to Edinburgh. No, I'm staying in London. I don't use the trains. And you just think, yeah, they're an idiot. This is the map of it now. The map of it is not, there's some stuff that we could do. It's actually, here is how our society is changing, and we either join in or we look like we don't care about society. And for me, the important thing to remember is that government is part of society. And what the internet is doing is busting open the doors of government and of all institutions and rooting them back into the communities which they serve, whether we like it or not. And we have a choice. We can either embrace these technologies and use them to help us manage that, or we have a giant problem on our hands, which is going to be hugely difficult to manage, hugely increased expectations on how we're going to respond, how we talk to people, the multiplicity of different tools. And people talk about digital inclusion. It's very important that we make sure that we're not trying to deliver everything through the internet, because I don't believe that there will ever be a time when 100% of people are able to use the internet. But remember that every technology is excluding. The written word is excluding. Fixed addresses are excluding. The phone is excluding. Everything's excluding to someone. And so the important thing is to give everybody options. So we don't set those terms. Our community, the public set the terms. And our job is to serve the public. So, okay, that's clear what we do. We don't do that. The thing to remember about the internet is that the internet is a post-industrial technology. Insert quote there, soundbite. Those of you on Twitter, feel free to go ahead. We've been taught for years, for 200 years, that technology is a means of centralization and automation. And so it makes things more efficient by enabling you to centralize and automate. And the internet works differently. It's connecting people individually to one another. It enables massive numbers of instantaneous, individual, person-to-person conversations happening everywhere all of the time. And it doesn't make things efficient by making them really effectively centralized and delivered. It makes things efficient by making them completely decentralized and massively manual. So the old way, the industrial way to run a badge-making company is to design a load of badges and build a factory and make badges and then sell them. And then you go, oh, we've got the internet. Great, we'll build a website for our badges and then we can sell more badges. This is brilliant. We love the internet. And then you get out-competed by somebody who's saying, hey, upload your own designs for the badges. And hey, actually, we don't have a factory. What we have is a set of tools that we give to people who need a bit of extra income, and they make the badges for us, and they ship them locally, which means that we have very little distribution costs, no overheads, no capital to invest, and actually all of the things that we're making have been designed by the people who want to buy them in the first place. So we have a guaranteed market, and all of our products sell. Buy industrial badge making company. Thanks for playing. And so what does this mean? What does this mean for public services? What does this mean for everyone? Everybody's trying to figure out what it means. No one knows what it means. It's full of, the sector is full of long-haired idiots like me going, yes, I know what it means. It's all this way. It's going to be red and we'll all live in trees. I have no idea. No one knows what it's going to be like. But I can tell you one thing, that we have an opportunity here to tackle some of the questions about co-design, co-delivery, about nothing for us without us, about personalization, about routing the services that we use back into society and helping everybody to get what they need from each other and from the society around us. And it, in the context of social care, it gives us an opportunity not just to produce social care services, but to make society more caring so that we need fewer services. Because society can start to care for itself if we facilitate that, if we build that. I think this is a bit abstract, so I'm going to just bring it down and give you a case study, which is Mind Apples, which is the project that I'm working on at the moment, and just give you a little bit of time just telling you about that. And then I have an idea of what you all can do. So I thought I'd leave you on that, and then we're going to take questions. But also feel free to jump up and say, you're an idiot, or I'm an anorak and I want to share my strange stat, or whatever it is. Just feel free to interrupt me. But Mind Apples, we are asking, what is the five a day for your mind? And there are actually quite a few people who are looking at this question. It's been a general theme in mental well-being. And I have a theory that mental health in the UK is broken. By which I mean, the term is completely broken. It doesn't mean mental health. It means illness. It means schizophrenia, depression, misery, suicide. It means a whole bunch of stuff which is actually illness, and whereas in the physical health world you have, here is cancer and heart disease, and over here you have gyms and looking good and enjoying your life and jogging. With mental health you have, here is depression, schizophrenia, misery, and over here you have, I don't know, but it's probably brightly coloured, it's fine, it'd be nice. And so what Mind Apples is trying to do is we're trying to shift mental health out of the medical model and put it back into society. And we aspire to be the cultural layer of good habits that supplements the clinical. We think the clinical work is very good, but we shouldn't be asking doctors to solve our lifestyle problems. It's not what they want to do. It's not what they were trained for. It's silly. And so what we do with Mind Apples is we start from this principle of the five-a-day hook, so it's about self-help, it's about how do people help themselves in various ways. Now, there's various bits of science of well-being, and part of it says that, the figures are disputed, but the suggestions are that around 40% of our mental well-being and health is influenced by our outlook and activities. So our lifestyle, our cognitive processes, our activities, the things we do, the things we think. And that's all manageable through culture and lifestyle and that societal sphere. So when you bear in mind that mental health, depending on which stat you read, costs either 77 billion or 110 billion pounds per year to the UK economy and public sector, if we could address even a small proportion of the 40% of that that's controllable through lifestyle, that would be a useful problem to solve, even just in this climate of efficiency and cost savings. This is a big problem. One third, about 10 years ago these stats are, one third of GP's time is spent dealing with mental health issues. One third. And actually quite a lot of it is to do with medically undiagnosed symptoms. So it's the grey area. And mental health has a big role to play on that. So what we do is we want to help everybody to see what it is that they could do to look after themselves. And it doesn't mean that you don't also get help, but we believe that if we can shift everybody from being passive and feeling that they're really not sure that they could do anything and actually trying not to think about mental health because they don't want to have schizophrenia and it's horrible. So, well, I don't want mental health. No mental health for me, please. Instead, we want to shift them to being actually, oh, mental health, that sounds great. I'd love some of that. That sounds like actually enjoying my lived experience. That's brilliant. Well done. Where do I sign? And we want to shift people from feeling that they are passive victims of a disease that they can't control to being actually in control. We want to give people a sense that they can do something about it. 40%. No one knows that. No one knows that they have minds. They only think about them when they go wrong. And actually, a huge amount of that can be controlled by simple stuff that we could do. But here's where it gets into back to what I was saying before about the post-industrial model, the non-mass production model. The old way of doing it is to do a whole load of research. The Foresight Report did this recently for the government, which is 400 doctors telling us what it is that science says we should do in order to look after our minds, amongst other things. I mean, it's a great report, but one of the strands of it is talking about what we should do, but actually it's just a piece of scientific evidence. And then you make mass-produced culture, you can get your printing press out, and you tell everybody, here are the things, we have the answer, and everyone goes, I'm fine, mate. What's up? What are you saying? I've got a problem. What's wrong with me? And actually telling people that they have to think about their mental health is quite a patronizing and offensive thing to do a lot of the time. So the social media approach is to flip it. And you go, what are your five a day? So my question to each of you, and I'd love to hear this afterwards, is what five things do you do that are good for your mind? And so we ask everybody to come up with their own answer. And then if those centralized lists are like the Richard and Judy book list, then we can be Amazon recommendations. So you don't have to go to the government to hear what your lifestyle should be. Doctors cannot prescribe lifestyle. They say, you should do some gardening. You go, I'm 12, what are you talking about? I have a window box, you're an idiot. And also, you know, it means that we can go to, say, kids in care who've had pretty traumatizing upbringings and say to them, tell us what you've figured out. You're an asset, you've been through all this stuff. What do you know? We can go to people who are, you know, suffering from bipolar disorder and ask them what they should tell people who are healthy about how they manage their mood, because they have got the more extreme version of that. They should have learned a load about it. And this journey for me actually started from conversations with my best friend who is bipolar, where she was trying to help me manage my stress levels and my depression, you know, and I'm fine. I'm over here on one side of the diagnosis line, and she's over here and she's broken. And actually, no, she's an asset. She's amazing. She helps me. So let's get the conversation open and let everybody join in, and we all find our own path. And that's what the internet enables us to do. So it's more than just the tools. So we build a website. Actually, we started with SurveyMonkey, a WordPress blog. Very easy. The tools are free. It's fine. The technology is not the issue. Clay Shirky said that, he's an author who writes about this kind of thing, organizing without organizations is his thing, how we mobilize ourselves, is that that technology becomes socially interesting when it becomes technologically boring. And the internet is kind of on the way to just being like, it just works, it's just fine, we take it for granted. And at that point it becomes really interesting, but what it's doing is creating a new approach. So yes, Mind Apples is a website, but I haven't really been talking much about technology and tools, have I? What I've been saying is this is a new mindset. So yes, we have a website where you can share it. We can also do events. We create big tree installations and take it around to the summer music festivals, and we ask stone teenagers, so can you tell us about how the things that you do affect your state of mind? And they go, wow, yeah, I've been experimenting with that for the last 15 years, mate. This is brilliant. And this and this. And they start off with like, yeah, ketamine and, in, you know, missionary position, cowgirl. And then after a while they go, wild swimming, dancing with my sister. And that's really interesting. What the internet does is it ratchets people up the levels of control. And people want control. If you want to engage people, offer them power. And quite often we try and engage people by saying, yes, we are enlightened princes, and we all live in a big castle. And we all know the rules, we know how everything should be lived. And those people down there are prole scum, and we hate them. And we want to empower them to become more like us so that they cost us less. This is the kind of eat less chips, fat poor people kind of model of behavior change. And actually, in the course of doing that, we will become angels, and we will become far better than them, because we will not only be superior like they are, but we will have helped them. And so we will always keep that distance, and it will always be safe up in our castle. Actually, no. What this is about is saying that the internet gives everybody the power to broadcast like only the state used to be able to, like only the church used to be able to. It ratchets everybody up. So everybody who was a reader of a magazine is now a writer of a magazine. Everybody who was a user of services can now provide services. Everybody who was previously being prescribed to can now prescribe. And take bipolar disorder, for example, and I know that this is a multiplicity of conditions actually under one umbrella, but a lot of it's self-management. most of the bipolar people I know self-manage. It's not like having cancer, although there are aspects of cancer which actually are self-managing, but it's not so clear-cut as we will fix it, it's fine. It's actually like diabetes. It's about saying, here are some tools, here's some information, now go and manage it and we will support you. And actually then you get things like todiabetes.com, which is where people get together and swap stories about what it's like to have diabetes and support each other, which is a project over in the States. Just free web tools to get everybody together into patient groups. And the guy who set it up did it because he got diagnosed with this, and then there was no support. And so he connected with a community of people who were all basically expert patients who'd lived through this, and they re-diagnosed him. And he had type, they told him he had the other type. So the crowd knew more than the doctors. This gets really exciting or scary, depending on what you think about the whole thing. So this is what I do, is what I do is I look for opportunities where the internet can connect us together to be more powerful than we were, or rather to remind us how powerful we always were. And so if you go to mindapples.org, you won't see any of us telling you what to do. We don't believe in that. What you will see is other people saying what works for them. And I believe that the most authentic, the healthiest way to design services is when, in my case, the first user should be me, if I'm designing it. And so MindApples is a project to figure out how to manage my mind. And thank you all for helping. It's great. It's really useful. I can't stand all these self-help gurus who are kind of like, yes, I figured out all the answers. Look at me. Hey, buy my book. You all too can be rich. It's horrible. It's top down. It's the wrong way around. And to take the word mental health, I think there are many words like this. Art is another. Home is another. Happiness. Culture. These are all placeholder words. They are not scientific words. I don't believe that mental health is a destination that we are all going towards. I believe it works like home. We all have a different home, but we all know what it's like to feel at home. And I think mental health is like that. And what MindApples does is it allows everybody to write their own stories, because I believe that the only way that we can actually find that path to being healthy and happy is to be a human being and to live our lives. And trying to prescribe that, it's impossible. You can't do that if you're the state, if you're an employer, if you are any kind of authority figure. You're robbing people of their right to be human by trying to tell them how to live. And don't do that. You don't need to. Everybody's on their own journey. Build the infrastructure to support everybody, and then we can do it ourselves. So what can you do? I have been talking a lot about public services, commissioning, all these things. I mean, actually, the reality is that we've got a whole infrastructure doing a whole bunch of very, very, very good work. And then this has come layered on top of it, and it's disrupting things. So how does the public sector respond is the question. And I think I have an answer. And this is completely unsubstantiated, so feel free to tear me apart once you've actually thought about it. But for now, this is the answer, which is MindApples is aspiring to be better than anybody else in the market at engaging people in thinking about the health of their minds and coming up with things to do. So we're about shifting attitudes in mental health. We're about giving people recommendations and suggestions that they actually listen to. And we're about building people's sense of control and agency. And we just want to do that bit. And so we're working with NHS Lambeth at the moment. We're starting to work with the NHS in South London to do this work to basically engage people on their behalf. Because actually, and this is the same for employers as well, if we go into workplaces, we can do that because we're impartial. We're not the authority figure. We can say, actually, we're just a piece of infrastructure. We're just here to help the conversation work better. So we get hired in to do that. And I would imagine that that £110 billion cost to the UK shows up in everybody's budget lines all over the place. The police, social services, the school system, the employers who have got sick leave problems and presenteeism. It shows up all over the place. So as an entrepreneur, what I'm doing is I'm identifying that need in the market. And then I'm trying to fill that need in an efficient way. And the elephant in the room, budget cuts. We all know this. The real cost savings that we're seeing from the internet are coming from disruptive innovation. And disruptive innovation I would characterize as what Amazon did to bookshops. And by coming in with a radically different model and shaving costs off all kinds of different bits across the system, you get much, much greater cost savings and a better product. And what we are seeing is that kind of thing happening here with the internet in the relation to the public sector, but nobody yet has ever suggested that the success of, for example, the NHS Direct website should be measured in how many GP surgeries it allows us to close. But those are the conversations that might start happening if things get worse. And so the question is, what are your needs, and is there a product out there that's independent of government, that's radically innovative, that's potentially disruptive, that you can go to and you can say, actually, we were going to solve this problem ourselves, but actually, if we give it to you to solve, we'll have done your first pilot. And then, actually, we'll put you in touch with our mates over here, because what you did was great, and we'll put you in touch with them, and you can do the second pilot, and the third pilot, and the fourth pilot. And by the way, actually, could you speak to our friends in central government, because we've now got to the point where we think there's a business case for this, and so the government is going to invest £250,000 in helping you scale up, in return for getting a discount on all of your services for the public sector. Leave the disruptive innovation stuff to the people outside the system. Your job is to figure out how to procure things on behalf of your wider community, solve your little problems, and then tell stories about it. And I think that actually, if we do that, we get all kinds of amazingly interesting things happening. And there's a quote by Winston Churchill, which is that there is a special moment in every man's life where fate metaphorically taps him upon the shoulder and offers him the chance to do the one thing for which he alone is perfectly suited. And woe betide the man who, when that call comes, is not ready. We must get ready. Thank you.